Jeffrey Archer is one of my favorite people to talk to, and not only that, he's a damn good author. His new book is An Eye for an Eye. It is out from HarperCollins, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jeffrey Archer back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I really appreciate it, as always.
Delighted to be with you, Joe. Thank you very much.
How did this latest entry come to be?
Strange thing, I met a man called Mr. Hartley, an Englishman, whose family have lived in the same house for 500 years. One of his ancestors, a British Member of Parliament, was a friend of Jefferson, Franklin, and Adams. And he believed, he was one of those rare people in England, he believed not only that independence was going to happen, he also thought it was a good thing. So he didn't make a lot of friends in the British House of Commons. But I found in his letters, I went to Mr. Hartley's home, the home in which the family have been for 500 years, and the present Willie Hartley, the present owner, showed me letters from Jefferson and from Adams and from Franklin, and one from Jefferson saying he had handwritten a Declaration of Independence, which he wanted Mr. Hartley to see, to show that he was sincere, that he had entered two clauses in the original, one about emancipation and the other about the role with Britain. They were both defeated by Congress by one vote, and he wanted to show Hartley that he'd been sincere in attempting to make law. Now, that document exists, Joe, and last month, which will, I hope, interest you, in Philadelphia, they sold a printed copy on the Franklin Press for $7.7 million. So I rang Sotheby's and said, what do you think a handwritten copy by the great man with the two extra clauses would be worth? And they suggested, with Trump and Musk bidding, around $100 million. So out there is a document that is worth $100 million. And that was the beginning of the idea.
So now, then, for reasons that I'm hoping you will explain, you felt that you wanted to actually have a version of Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, for want of a better term, to be recreated for you.
Yes. Because in the story, the wicked Max Faulkner, when our hero goes to jail in Saudi Arabia for a murder he did not commit, Miles Faulkner moves in and attempts to get hold of the declaration for almost nothing, knowing that he's in possession of a document worth $100 million. I have two brilliant police researchers, both retired from the Metropolitan Police in London, and one of them, who'd worked in the Arts and Antique Squad, Michelle Roycroft. I said to her, have you ever arrested a forger? And she said, I arrested the best, Billy Mumford, the best. And now Billy came to see me. He's now out of jail and going straight. I said, is it possible for you to produce the Declaration of Independence as if it had been written by Jefferson? It took him 14 weeks to do it. In fact, I have it in the room in front of me, Joe. It's a complete masterpiece. It cost me about $2,000. If it was real, it'd be worth $100 million. But I now know from the point of view of the book, from the point of view of An Eye for an Eye, that it is possible for it to be done. I have it in my room.
I'm looking at a picture of it, and it just is remarkable how real it looks, and especially the aging of the paper, of the watermarks, the lightness and the darkness of the paper, the striations. It's really incredible.
I asked him how he did that, Joe, and he said conker oil and tea leaves. First, he had to get the right paper because it had to look old to start with. Then conker oil and tea leaves. Then he had to get the right ink, had to be 200 years old. Then he had to get the right pen. Then, of course, he had to study, and this is where Mr. Hartley was so kind. He allowed us to have the letters on loan that Jefferson had written to his great-great-great-great-great, etc., father. And so my forger had real letters by Jefferson and sat down and wrote the Declaration of Independence. Yes, you're quite right, Joe. It's remarkable.
For you, in the research of the book, to talk to someone like Billy, to be able to learn from them and to understand, as you're trying to write about the art world and forgery, to understand someone who has been successful at it, and so successful they were eventually arrested and put away.
Yes, I have always said research is reading. In fact, for my next book on the table in front of me, there are 11 books I'm going to have to read in the next 3 months. But I said it's equally important to meet people who are experts in their field. And Billy Mumford is a classic example of an expert in his field. He can knock you up a Picasso overnight. He can give you a Dali. He's done me a Rembrandt again for the book. And, of course, he's done this Declaration of Independence. So you're quite right. I believe research is not just books and scholarship. It's human beings.
Obviously, these novels feature William Warwick and his nemesis, Miles Faulkner. How did it become just natural that they would take on and be a part of this crime and case?
Well, that's kind of, remembering I'm on the seventh of eight books, and in the first one, nothing ventured when William Warwick is a constable, and through the different books, he moves up in rank, and now in An Eye for an Eye, he is a chief superintendent, and in the final book, we will discover whether he's going to be commissioner. But to answer your question, it's sort of osmosis almost, Joe. It just grows and grows and grows. They become like a family, and you watch them growing together. That's part of the fun. And, of course, what I've had to worry about in the final book, which will come next year, is will William become commissioner? And how do I finally deal with Miles Faulkner? You might find one or two surprises there, Joe.
At the very end of this book, there is the announcement that the countdown begins for the final novel for William Warwick. At what point did you come to that decision that it was time to wind it down?
Well, I'm 84, Joe, and I started this when I was 77. But the actual answer is it took care of itself, because if you go constable, sergeant, inspector, chief inspector, superintendent, chief superintendent, commander, possibly commissioner, there's eight books. So it worked itself in that way. And as you'll remember, every book is a different subject. So you have art fraud, you have drugs, you have murder, you have international protocol. And this one is the international protocol one. And the final one will be about the Olympic Games. So it's a new rank and a new subject each time. That's what made it fun for me. And indeed, my two great researchers, retired police officers, if I said, I now need to meet the head of the drug squad, I now need to meet the head of the murder squad, I now need to meet the chief of protocol, they supplied them, and I was able to sit with them and grill them, and then they'd read the books and tell me what just couldn't happen and what could happen. So I've been very lucky to have world-class experts advising me.
And that just seems like the fun part, right? I mean, that just seems like a joy to work with those folks and to figure out what the story is going to be.
You're absolutely right. It's fun and a privilege, because they often guide you in a direction you would never have considered. And they also stop you going in a direction that is not possible. So that if a British police officer read the book, would say it was drivel. That can't happen, because I'm so well advised. And they read drafts 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. They read all the final drafts until the book goes out. The book you have in front of you of An Eye for an Eye is the 14th draft. And they've read everything from the 7th draft. And they wouldn't have their names in the book as advisors if they weren't happy.
What is it about the rewriting process? Is that an enjoyable process in the sense of that you basically have taken 14 cracks at it to get the one that is out on the store shelves?
Well, I'll give you an example, if I may, Joe. You don't get it all on the first draft. You don't get the story. You might get the story down, but it just gets sharper and sharper. And I'll give you an example. The next one's about the Olympics. And in the Olympics, Britain beat the French to get the Olympics in 2012 by 4 votes. Historically, what actually happened, 2 days later, there was a bomb in the London Underground. 2 people were killed and 70 injured. If the vote had been 2 days later rather than 2 days before, we would have lost that vote to the French. That's a simple fact. Now, my police officer, William Warwick, has to tell the people that the Prime Minister has rung up and said, congratulations on winning it, but you have to come back very quietly indeed, and slip home. We can't have great celebrations at London Airport after this terrible terrorist attack, which, of course, we understood. And he instructs my man to tell them that this must happen. But they just won, and they're all drunk. They've been up all night drinking. They're just about woken up. And now, to answer your question, Joe, I wrote the sentence when Commander Warwick faces them, he looks at them, and I wrote the sentence, all of them were somber, few of them were sober. That doesn't come in the first draft, Joe.
And I guess the obvious question for me would be, when do you know you have it right? When do you know that that's the line that
that's
you want
to end with?
That's
a very good question. And the answer is, when you are on the last one, if you're only changing one word every 3 pages, you're only adding or taking out a sentence every chapter, you're there. But while you're still making quite big changes, a paragraph, maybe even 2 paragraphs, you're not there. You know when you're there, when it just runs smoothly.
The Warwick novels, the Clifton Chronicles, all of the standalone novels, the short stories, you've done screenplays. I mean, I guess all of that has its, with the possible exception of the Prison Diaries, that all of those are fun to engage in different ways.
They're damned hard work. I'm luckily doing a job I enjoy. Still at the age of 84, I get up at 5:30 every morning and work 6 to 8 on the first session, and I still enjoy it. And this is just sheer luck, still get ideas every single day. When that stops, Joe, I will stop. But while it's still flowing, and it's flowing like mad at the moment, I shall go on until I fall. And I will tell you with singular pride, Joe, that a few moments ago, just before you called, I looked at the book's been out in England in 1 week. It's had 600 people reviews in 5 days, and they've nominated it 4.7 out of 5. The people have. I haven't had that since Cain and Abel. So that was a very special moment for me when you just before you rang.
Do you have a sense after all of these years and after all of the novels and the books of what it is about your work that has struck a chord with readers?
I think it's storytelling. One attempts to win awards, of course. One's very proud when one does win an award. But they did a cloud on me, my publishers, about 10 years ago. And they asked the public, please let us know why you buy a Jeffrey Archer book. And they have clouds, big clouds, little clouds. The biggest cloud I thought was going to be storytelling. It wasn't. It was the second biggest cloud. To answer your question, the first biggest cloud was characters. They like William Warwick. They like Miles Faulkner. They like Ross Hogan. And so characters are very important. People like going back to them. And in the Clifton Chronicles, which went to number one on the New York Times, they liked Harry. They liked Beth. And I think it's characters in the end, Joe.
The name of the new novel is An Eye for an Eye. It is just out from HarperCollins. Jeffrey Archer, it's always a delight to speak to you. Thank you so much for spending time with us, and best of luck. Continued luck with the new novel.
That's very kind, Joe. It's always a pleasure.
Again, the name of the book is An Eye for an Eye. It is published by HarperCollins by Jeffrey Archer. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.